Welcome to Headlines Radio. This is David Lichtenstein. This week we will have one of the Rosh Yeshivas in the Mir in Yerushalayim, Rav HaGaon, Rabbi Nissen Kaplan. He says a shiur for over 200 boys, which, you know, would make him in America probably perhaps the largest maggid shiur in America. The Mir does have some very other big classes. But he's a beloved. He has many Talmidim in Lakewood. In fact, the guest of honor at the Mir Yerushalayim get-together in Lakewood last week, he said, was one of his Talmidim. He's going to be speaking about two interesting topics. One is going to hotels for Yom Tovim. I think he's going to speak more Hashkafa than Halacha, we'll hear. And additionally, he's going to speak about, we'll have a conversation about Shalom Bayis, because he has a lot of newly married boys in his shiurim, so I guess he gets a lot. What are you allowed to do for Shalom Bayis? Can you lie for Shalom Bayis? Can you mitigate, you know, the difference in kosher standards for Shalom Bayis, for kosher, etc.? So he's going to speak about these two very topics. So we'll have him on in a few minutes. Since it's Elul, Rosh Hashanah is coming up, I just thought I would say a short thought about it. You know, the acronym for Elul is Ani L'Dodi V'Dodi Li. I am for my beloved, and my beloved is for me. Because Elul, Rosh Hashanah, is historically a time for forgiveness. Everybody knows, for starters, I mean, Rosh Hashanah is a time, and Yom Kippur are times to asking Hashem for forgiveness, asking God for forgiveness, and asking other people that we've hurt for forgiveness. And in fact, the prayer, the tefillah of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is the tefillah of the Yud Gimel Midas HaRachmim, the 13 attributes with which God forgave Klal Yisrael, the attributes of forgiveness. So here's an interesting thing. Why do we approach, as Jews, the new year so differently than most, of the world, of the secular world? For example, think of it. What happens in the United States before on New Year's Day? Well, I think this year it was almost 3 million people packed Times Square. Most of them had some type of an alcoholic beverage in hand, right? The level of inebriation was high. And, you know, they stand together and they watch the crystal ball fall. And there's a huge countdown. And it's, you know, watched all over the world. And there's partying and fireworks and celebration. Now, why is it about the Jewish New Year's that it's really very quite different? It starts with forgiveness and on Yom Kippur, fasting and asking and working out. Like, do we have it wrong? Like, what is it? Now, here's an interesting thing. You know, everybody would agree, or most people would agree, that there's a very high level of success and productivity by Jews. They seem to work harder, and many of them, there are many who aren't, but many of them are successful. What is it about the culture of the Torah, of the Bible, that allows, is there something in it that allows for success? So let me share a thought with you. Every day is a new day, and you can begin it. So two people are going on a race. One person is carrying on his back a knapsack, a 60-pound knapsack, and the other guy is wearing, you know, a pair of shorts, running shoes. They're both wearing shorts, running shoes, you know, one of those t-shirts. They all look so limber. One guy has a heavy knapsack on his back. Well, who's going to last longer? Right? The person carrying. Now imagine if it's not a 60-pound knapsack, but it's a suitcase full of bricks. Now, that's not going to be an easy race. So think of it. We're starting a new year. And what does a new year mean? We have dreams. We have aspirations. We always do. How is this coming year going to be the year that we want, that we have accomplishment, success in business, socially, with our family, with relationships, etc., with our Yir Shamayim? So we can start the year carrying a bag of bricks on our back, or we can start the year with forgiveness. What does forgiveness mean? All the anger, the hurt of yesterday, trying to shed it. I ask you, can you drive while your eyes are glued to the rearview mirror? Right? So the 13 attributes of forgiveness, the Yud Gimel Midas HaRachmim, right? So we are supposed to emulate them. It's Ma'ani Afata. Just like Hashem, God, forgives us, we are supposed to use those same attributes to forgive others who've hurt us. And here's something you probably haven't heard that much before. Who's the main person we have to forgive? Your wife? No. More than your wife. Your mother? Not so sure about that one. Your parents, your partner, who maybe took a little bit more than he was supposed to. Okay, but even more than all of those is yourself. Because you say things to yourself that nobody would ever say to you. That voice screaming at you in your mind, how could I have done? I can't believe it. I should have. That voice in your head says to you things that nobody says to you. Your enemy in his worst moments wouldn't dare to say the things that voice in your head says to you. So what's holding us back in that race, carrying all those bricks, is forgiveness, others, but even more than that, ourselves. Now, how do I know that you have to forgive yourself? I'll tell you how I know. It says, V'ahavta l'reyecha, love thy neighbor, kamoicha, like you love yourself. If you don't love yourself, you can't love others. In fact, according to the Rambam, the whole shir of V'ahavta l'reyecha is really very personal. What do I see? How do I love myself? So why is it so hard to forgive? I mean, most people really struggle with forgiveness. I know a person, he never forgave his father for things that the way he brought him up. And he told me he has not been to his father's grave ever. He can't forgive his father. Some of us, it's a parent. Some of us, it's a neighbor. Some of us, it's a child, Rahman al-Assan. All these things, why can't we forgive? What holds us back from letting go? And by not letting go means, why does yesterday prevent today from happening to you? Why is your past stopping your future? What prevents that? So there's a few reasons. And one reason is because inside of most people, there's a strong sense of right and wrong. You know, if you had a chance, there was a study done by a psychologist. He said that if you were given, they took a bunch of people and they put them in a room and they said, each of you has a $20 bill. And then they had on the other side of the testing people, they had a sort of a prop that they had put in with instructions. And here were the instructions. They said, everybody here, there's two of you, you have a $20 bill, you can split it, but only if both of you agree. So what they had is they had the prop say, I want 15 out of the $20. And if you can't agree, it goes back to the house. None of you get the money. A majority of the people said, rather than only take $5 and give the other person 15, I would rather not take it. Because my sense of right and wrong is such, I would rather be $5 poorer than split it in a way that is unfair. So we have innately, and you see that in America today, you know, there's this whole tumult going on about immigration. And, you know, Trump, you know, the ugly American, somebody who thinks that the seven evil vices seem to be attributes, he's come out against immigration and he wants to deport, you know, 15 million people, and many of them have children already who are American citizens. He would leave children abandoned by their parents, etc., because the sense of immigration has struck such a chord in the Republican Party. And if you read some of the comments, it's sort of like, you know, I worked so hard to be legal here. Why should that person get it for free? Or I work so hard to pay my taxes, and why should those people not have to listen to the law, even though they're desperate? Or, you know, we saw the same thing when they wanted to have banks do mortgage, wipe out, you know, balances of mortgages for, you know, mortgages that exceeded the value of the home, to right-size the mortgage. And a lot of people said, I've worked so hard. I get up every morning, 6 o'clock in the morning. I run to work to pay my mortgage. Why should that person have his mortgage wiped out if he took a mortgage more than the house is worth? So I think as humans, we have like a very strong sense of right and wrong, sense of fairness. And when we think our sense of fairness is being violated, we get very upset. It cuts to the core of what we believe to be real and true and honest. So when you think of it, what does forgiving somebody mean? It means somebody did something to me that was nasty, bad, right? If I forgive them, it's sort of like an abdication of my sense of right and wrong. I try to live a good life, an honest life, a real life. When I forgive you, I'm saying my entire values are going out the window because I'm turning the other cheek. I'm being a nice guy. And that really upsets us. There are other reasons as well, but I think that's the one reason I want to focus on today. So, but we're supposed to forgive. Right? And it's for our benefit. Let's face it, we do want to have a tomorrow. You do want to be successful. You don't want to spend that much of your energy looking in the rearview mirror fighting battles of yesterday. So how do we do it? How do we overcome that sense of forgiveness? So the Yud Gimel, the 13 attributes of mercy that our Rebbeinu Shlomo forgives us with, we are supposed to learn from. So the question is, how do we forgive somebody who was unfair to us, somebody who was nasty to us without losing that sense of right or wrong? So let's look at them and let's see what we could learn. So what's the first of the 13 midas? It says, Hashem, Hashem, God, O God, Kel Rachum Mechanan, and merciful, just, etc. So let's talk about, so the Talmud says, the Gemara says in Rosh Hashanah, why does it say God's name twice? To teach you that God forgives once before the sin, and once after the sin. Now, after somebody does something wrong to you, somebody crashed up your car that you lent them for a date, right? We can understand why you would have to forgive after. But what does it mean forgive before they did anything wrong? What is that to forgive? And if we understand that, we can understand how we, an attribute that we're supposed to, what does it mean that we should forgive before the other person did something wrong to me? So let me give you an idea, okay? And where do we see it, by the way, that God forgives before? It says, Ki yetzer lev adam ra min urav. God says, I will forgive, I will not destroy anymore, because I know man is bad from the very beginning. What does that mean? I was on a ranch recently, and the farmer was telling me that when a calf is born, they're born, they're 75 to 100 pounds, and the minute they're born, or he said, actually, a few minutes later, they stand up and walk away. Now, compare that to yourself. It probably took you someplace between, I don't know, a year and 3 years to start walking, right? And what does that mean? As humans, we are all born really very needy, flawed, and damaged. You don't believe me? I say socially, economically, psychologically, culturally, we are worse off than animals in many ways. We are born flawed. You don't believe me? Go to a kindergarten or a playground. See how the kids treat each other when the teacher is not around. Oh, you don't remember? So let me bring your memory back. Do you remember high school? I heard somebody recently interviewed. He was in Rikers Island, which is probably the toughest prison in the United States. He said, Rikers Island, it was sort of like high school, except that everybody has knives. So, right, what about Shidduchim? Do you remember that? You think people are nice? So we are born flawed. We are born in a toxic environment, in a hurtful environment. We need constant support. What about economically? How many years did it take you to learn how to earn a living? Do you remember your first jobs? What about today? Now compare that to the fox that just hunts for rabbits, or the rabbit for that matter, that eats any piece of grass that comes its way. We as humans, every part of our life is a struggle. Every single part. So when Hashem comes to forgive us, he says, I know the human has it very, very difficult. And what does that mean to say? Do we maybe expect too much of our partners? Do we were born so needy, so damaged, with such a struggle, everything. Do I maybe expect too much? Could it be that maybe I expect too much of my spouse? Like, is it really realistic, before they've done anything wrong, when you get married, to expect your spouse to be at that same weight for many years afterwards? Or who says that your child should be number one in his class? Like, whatever gave you that idea? I'm not talking about not having expectations. I'm just talking about having realistic expectations. And what about yourself? I know you really wanted to be number one in A, B, C, D, E, but you know what? There's 7 billion people in the world, and all of them want to be. Like, is it really realistic that I should be number one at so many different things? I may be being a little bit too demanding. Are you really being realistic? And why do I say this? Because the concept of forgiveness beforehand is, if we come into relationships, and remember, Elul is Ani L'Dodi V'Dodi Li, it's all about relationships, with realistic expectations, yes, I know, honey, you will not wear makeup every day of your life, nor will I be at the same weight, nor do I promise to always get up on time, or always be in a good mood, and he won't be, or she won't be, it's just impossible. So forgiveness beforehand means that afterwards, there was no reason to forgive anymore, because you were just honest, and I wasn't disappointed, because I know I'm living with a human. Let me give you an extreme story, but it brings it out. Remember that, let me tell you a line, I think it's just an important line. We're all challenged, it's all difficult, and we're challenged in different ways. So just because somebody doesn't love you the way you want to be loved, it doesn't mean they're not loving you the best that they can. So, you know, I have a good friend, Dr. Pelkowitz. He's one of the most famous psychologists in the world. And he tells me this mesmerizing story. He says that a patient comes to him, and the person he's angry at his father. This is a middle-aged, successful businessman, and it's eating up. He hasn't gotten along with his father in years. His father has since been niftar, has passed away. And his anger at the way his father treated him is just eating him up. And Dr. Pelkowitz says, I tried to help this man. We spoke about it, and I just couldn't get to the bottom of it. His father was a Holocaust survivor, came to America. He says, my father was very normal till I was like 14 or 15. I thought I had a normal. And he says, like a year after my bar mitzvah, so a year and a half afterwards, he says, you know, we were playing baseball after school. My father came to pick me up, and he sees me playing baseball, and he starts screaming in front of all my friends, what a waste of time. Why are you playing? In his heavy accent. What kind of thing is this? All these sports. And my friends were aghast. He says, I turned purple. And after that, he said, he so often exploded. He said, so at some point, I stopped having anything to do with my father. Went away to yeshiva, to school. He says, when I got engaged, I wasn't going to invite him to our wedding. He says, and my fiance, very sweet girl, he said, I'm married for many years now, said, you have to invite your father to your wedding. So I went, I made up, I invited my father to the wedding. He says, after the wedding, after the chuppah, everybody's getting together, and everybody was wishing us congratulations, mazel tov, my father's standing there, and suddenly he says, you look so happy now. Wait till life hits you in the back. We'll see how happy you are then. And my father starts carrying on, and it created such a commotion. He said, and I really, afterwards, went back. I said, you know, to my wife, I said, it's safer having nothing to do with him than having something to do with him. He says, and my father since passed away, and it still makes me nuts. So Dr. Pelkowitz says, I said, go back, find some old friend of your father's, get me some more information. So he says, I find this old survivor, and he says, what was my father like? He says, we had the greatest childhood. He says, until around a year or two after your father's bar mitzvah, the Nazis rolled into town. He says, and I still remember it like yesterday. We were all playing in the square, and a car pulls up, and a big, tall guy gets out, you know, wearing the uniform, and he sees, and your father was playing soccer, and he calls your father over, and he takes out a stanchion, like a big stick, you know, the club that they had, and he says, no more playing for children here. And he hit him on the head, like full force, with a wooden stick, and he fell flat. He said he kicked him a few times, and he said, we never played again after that. The Nazis were in town. And he says, so then your father got up. He says, we were there for another year, and then we went to labor camps. He says, do you know, when your father was in a labor camp, there was a girl from the city, one of the few survivors, and your father fell in love with her. And they used to talk over the fence. And one day, she's not there anymore. And he says, what happened? He asks. She was raped by one of the guards, and when they became pregnant, they were shot. He says, so they killed her. He says, that was the girl he fell in love with at the camps. See, this guy said, he said, I listened to this guy, and on the way home, I said to myself, you know, it was just right after my bar mitzvah that my father blew up at me. And then by the wedding, when he saw me and my kala, I could just imagine now what he was reliving. So Dr. Pelkowitz said, he said he went to his father's grave, he asked him for forgiveness, and since then he fell out of the hole, and the whole, posthumously, the entire relationship changed. But that's the point. Just because somebody doesn't love us the way we want doesn't mean that they don't love us the best that they can. So understanding that we are flawed and everybody we love is flawed and they may be doing the best that they know how, it's some way to forgive before anything goes wrong. Have realistic expectations. And that is the Torah's first, Hashem Hashem, the first step towards coming to forgiveness. We have with us on the radio from Eretz Yisrael, on the telephone, may I say, Harav HaGaon, Rabbi Nissen Kaplan. He's one of the Rosh Yeshivas in the Mir in Yerushalayim. He has approximately 200 boys in his shir, which makes it one of the largest shiurim, Torah shiurim, in the world. Additionally, there are numerous, perhaps dozens of shiurim available online as well. Welcome, Rav Kaplan.
Shalom Aleichem. Welcome. Good morning to all of you.
So, Rabbi Kaplan, many Rabbanim have been speaking about going to hotels for Yom Tov. In fact, there are hotels here in America that are open for the Yom Narayim, too, for Rosh Hashanah. What are the issues with going to a hotel for Yom Tov?
So I think we'll have to divide it into several issues. We'll talk, if the condition is that the hotel, the kashrus is okay, the food is proper, the program is proper, and the first thing that we have to really bring up is if it's the right thing to go Yom Tov to a hotel or it's the better thing to stay home. If after we figure that out, we have to really figure out that we choose the right place, the right kashrus, the right atmosphere. But I want really to start with the first point. For sure, as people that cannot do Yom Tov for several reasons, if it's medical reasons or they're, you know, they don't have someone to help them, one parent family, and they have to go to a hotel, we're not discussing for sure when you can't, it's not a discussion. Our discussion is what is the ideal place to have a Yom Tov. And the real thing is that the most ideal for a family is the Yomim Tovim, the Yomim Neroim, when the family is together, is the time that you build the family. You build the love in between the kids and the parents. All of us, I'll say most of us, grew up, our parents did not go to hotels. It was not so available in our days. I'm speaking to a little bit to the medium generation. All of us remember the beautiful Purim, the beautiful Mishlach Manos that the mother sends us to give to the neighbor, the stealing the afikomen from the father, standing in the shul and the rav before Kol Nidre is crying, before Ne'ilah crying, the shofar in the end of davening. All of us have these beautiful, nice memories. This is a part of the Jewish memory family connection that a person has. When you go to a hotel, there's a lot of nice things in the hotel. There's a lot of nice programs. But the first thing is, the kid most time loses the family connection. The family connection, when he's with a big dining room, and in the other table he sees that, and the mezamrim are sitting in the middle. He doesn't have that sitting near his father, getting from his father, Leman tesaper be'oznei bincho uben bincho es asher yotzoso mimitzrayim. We send them, we have beautiful schools today, all over the world. Such good mechanchim, such good programs. But then we have the family. Leman tesaper be'oznei bincho uben bincho. Shabbos ato bincho ubitecho. Hashem said the little kids have to not do melacha and Shabbos. They don't understand what is Shabbos. But they're with the parents, Leman Yonuach Bincho. A father has a special mitzvah that his son will rest in Shabbos. The Shabbos is the time that the family gets together. The Yontif is the time the family gets together. So the first thing is that that beauty of Yontif that passes from generation to generation, you lose it when you go to the hotel. It's not a terrible thing, but you lose a very good thing that you could give over, even if the hotel has the nice program. The second thing is,
Rabbi Kaplan, let me just interrupt to be meisif a little bit. What you're saying is the first mitzvah given to Klal Yisrael, not to the Bezdin, in other words, not to this Kainim or to Bezdin, but given to the individuals of Klal Yisrael, is the concept of v'yikru lechem ish selabes avoy selabayis, sitting with your family by the meal.
You're exactly to the point, and I want to add, you know, it's the only mitzvah that I will call it a jail. They don't let you to switch houses in the middle of Pesach, even to visit your uncle, to go to visit Uncle Sam on the other side of the street, or Michael, you're not allowed to. Why? We just wanted to go for dessert to the neighbors. And the first mitzvah, they say, do it family, and please, not to go around. We want a lot of people to eat together, but how much people can already be on one sheep? And they eat it in one place, and they're not allowed to go even out of dessert, because we want them to be focused with the family.
Yeah, and let me be meisif, Rav Kaplan, to what you're saying, that I'm in construction. And I remember when I was starting to build buildings, I would sit with the builder, and he would take a 2x4 and show me that he's going up 12 stories. And I would say, how much weight does a 2x4 carry? So he would say, if it's a wood 2x4, 600 pounds. If it's a aluminum 2x4, 1,300 pounds. I said, how is this going to carry a building that weighs 1 million tons? So he said, a single 2x4 could carry 600 pounds. But when it's interwoven, it's nailed to this one and supported by the other one, and it's part of the structure, it could support 1,000 times that amount. And I think that in life, there are so many times we fall down, we hurt ourselves, a child gets, a bully says something to him, and if he's part of the family, it's like the 2x4 that's connected in 1,000 ways and could support 1,000 times its regular strength. And that's the family meal that you're discussing.
Correct, correct. I would add one line. You know, some people will ask you on that. You know, but a lot of good friends, a lot of people from the program, you know, people from the Bungalow County, all these people are also really supporters and friends. And the answer is, it's true. But you know, when someone loses his father, his mother, chas v'sholem, something bad happens to a person. Sometimes his friends are near him, and sometimes in life the friends left. But the ones that come back is the brothers and sisters. And every different occasion in life, they gather together and they stand there with you. And if that structure is healthy and strong, it supports, like you said, A, B, it gives over the generations our religion. And that is so important.
So are there exceptions? Would you say there are people who should go to a hotel for shishas?
Right. Now, for example, sometimes you have a family. I'll start from there. You know, that the parents are not getting along at the moment. They're having a little bit issues. And if they'll be home, the yontif will be a disaster for the kids. I will tell them, go to a hotel. Sometimes it's a family that the parents just had an operation. Someone just has to rest. Sometimes, for different reasons, they cannot manage. If it's because, you know, they don't have food to cook, they don't have a house, they don't have how to do it, they don't have the mesorah yet how to do it, these people, for sure, I would suggest them to go. Even sometimes people that need sometimes a change, I would not fight it. But to bring it up, I'll give you an example. I got a phone call from someone that is very, very close to me. He was a boy in the mirror, became very successful. He lived in San Diego, actually. Now he lives in Lakewood. And he called me and he asked me, Rosh Hashanah, I got this phone call yesterday, actually, and 2 days ago. I'm going to a program or I'm not going to a program. And, you know, he moved into Lakewood. He's working. He's a very successful. He's secular. But, you know, he moved to Lakewood. He wants to be a little bit more on the Hamish side, like you call it. And he said, you know, his wife is not ready yet. You know, they grew up their whole life and going to programs for Rosh Hashanah. And we'll get to that in a second. What to do? So I told him, if all of your life you went to a program, and this is the way the family grew up, you're right that now maybe you want to change it. You just moved to Lakewood now. It's not time to fight it. All of the family, all of her family goes to a hotel, join them. Slowly, slowly, when you settle in and you get used to the shul, used to the rav, then I will switch you back to have a regular yontif in your house. Because he was never brought up to go to shul. They never stand in shul. She never saw shul in Rosh Hashanah. And this really brings me to the second part. We're standing before Rosh Hashanah, and I think the question is divided to couple areas. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, A, Sukkot Shavuos, B, and Pesach, the third thing. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is really a time that a person has to focus about davening. So from one point, being in a hotel, in a position of a hotel, I want to say over a little verse of the Biskirov, that I heard of Shach, one of the biggest, greatest people in Eretz Yisrael. He met the Biskirov 2 days before Rosh Hashanah. And the Biskirov was shaking. He was so nervous. And he asked him, Rabbi, why are you so nervous? You know, the halacha says we dress up beautiful on Rosh Hashanah. We lay out the table with such nice food, the head of the sheep or the head of the fish, the apple, and all the nice simanim. And we know, Chazal tell us, we're not like the Umas HaOlam that are scared. We are betuchim sheniske v'din. We're sure that Hashem will save us and Hashem will give us Hashana Toivo Mesuke, that I'm sure that He will. So why are you so nervous? Chazal say, if you're not nervous and you party, I'll not say party, but if you're happy, you dress nicely, and you betuchim sheniske v'din, Hashem gives you a good year. If you act like that, He actually gives you the good year. So Rabbi, you're the greatest rabbi of the Jewish generation, your own generation, and you are nervous? You're not setting the right example. You know, Rosh Hashanah has to be like a yontif. So he told him, I will tell you. A little kid, 2 years old, is walking into a hospital. He's going to a very serious surgery. The chances that he will survive are less than 5%. His parents are shaking. Him, everyone is crying. He's so happy they just gave him a balloon, and when they put him on the bed, they gave him also a lollipop to hold and a little train. He's so happy. It's called that he's batuach. It's called that he's secure. He just doesn't know what is going to happen. Rosh Hashanah doesn't mean sit there and don't be scared. You have to know that Hashem is judging the world. You have to know what it is. And after you know what it is, and you know how scary it is, then you say, but I'm sure that Hashem will take care of me. But to deny it, and not to be even nervous, and to live like it's one of the holidays, that I'm just going for a vacation, this is against the purpose of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And like I'm saying again, a lot of people, like I say, I advise one of my closest Talmidim to go to a program. A lot of people, it's very important for them. They're older, they can't do it themselves, or the family was brought up like that, and it's very hard to change it. They don't have a shul that they could daven properly. They can't get enough seats in the shul. It could be a lot of good reasons. But if a person is asking us, without no coming before, without no ideas, what is the ideal place for me? Is to go to a shul, to be serious, for to go home in between for the meals, and to do it betuchim shenitzei v'din, with nice, with the simanim, and to focus on the simanim. And my family, we focus an hour on the simanim. And we speak about it, and we speak about every siman, and the kids are so excited. And it's not about the steak, or the good chicken, or the Chinese food that is served in between. The kids get a feeling of Rosh Hashanah. The father comes back from shul. He's wearing this white, beautiful kittel. We walk to shul. We see the Rav. We hear kiss the Sefer Torah. It's something very special, very Rosh Hashanah thing. So Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is the most least days that I would advise people to go to a hotel if they don't have to. Sukkot is easier. It's a time of Zman Simchas Reinu. This year we have a different problem. We don't feel the mitzvah sukkah so much. Even if the hotel provides a very big sukkah. You know, I'm sure all of us know these little songs about how beautiful that little sukkah, that the wind is blowing the sukkah and Hashem is keeping the sukkah. My little sukkah, my green little leaves, Klal Yisrael every year sat in sukkahs. When you go to the hotel, lose that little beauty of the kid bringing the decorations from the kindergarten and hanging it on the sukkah. So you're right, as the Yom HaDin, there's no problem. Sukkot is Zman Simchas Reinu, it's a nice time. But the kids don't get that feeling, sleeping in a sukkah, sitting in a sukkah. My mother, she sat in Siberia in prison for a couple of years in the middle of the war. They took her. And the story how they managed in the middle of the night to sit in the sukkah under the snow, and they're moving the snow, and they're scared someone will catch them. We have so much stories on the Holocaust, how people are running to the sukkah. The kid knows that it's sukkahs, but he doesn't get that feeling. And in sukkahs, like you mentioned before, Hashem says, it can't be l'malo me'esrim amo because we want the kids to know ki basuka yisheshavti. Tse midiras kva v'lech ladiras arev. Shem azam and Erbach would tell me every time, I'm such an old man, and Hashem told me, leave my house, go to inside these doors, this wood. Al pi aloha, the sukkahs are okay. The hotels, Baruch Hashem, are good. We're speaking about these kind of programs. But I can feel the tse midiras kva ladiras arev. We're missing that little point. So again, it's missing. And Leila Seder, like you spoke, Leila Seder is a different problem, especially the first night. I would say the other nights are much easier. But the first night is Leila Seder. The first night is Leila Seder. You're missing the Seder, the family Seder.
Well, they can make a family Seder.
You can make a private Seder, you're right. Most people do. Right. But again, you know, the Shulchan Aruch is, they're running it in, they're running it out. You know, you have that little time that you run, you're running around the schedule, we call it, yeah?
Yeah, but Rav Kaplan, well, yeah. let me just point out maybe a little bit of another way to view it. You know, everybody in every time, how you absorb Yiddishkeit or Kedusha or family, it changes. And if you would take a child who grew up in the United States today, where they have, you know, the kids are very exposed. Now, I'm not talking about a kid necessarily growing up in Lakewood, a kid growing up in Manhattan and the five towns, and a more affluent area, more open-minded area. There's something very containing about, well, almost boring. I'm stuck with the family, the entire. When you go to a hotel, it gives it a different type of richness, and I can be with friends, I can travel, and it gives the Yom Tov a different spirit. And it's very true that that's different than the spirit of our Babis. But our babies never had to deal with internet, and they never had, you know, internet on their phones and instant connectivity and Facebook. So sometimes is it possible that we have to move with the times and keep our arms around our children, but remaining contemporary?
I think you're right. And this video was what I was saying the whole time. Like, people that grew up like that, I will not stop them. Like this girl, that the only what she knows about Rosh Hashanah is going to a hotel. If she will start to be in late with Rosh Hashanah, it should be a miserable time. But I'll give you an example. I think this week was a big dinner for Yeshiva Smir in Lakewood. One of my talmidim was the honoree. I didn't manage to make it. He's very close to me, and Baruch Hashem, he's very well to do. But you know what he does, Sukkot? He comes to Eretz Yisrael, and Hoshana Rabbah, with his family, they crowd together in my little Sukkah. Imagine yourself that it's not, it's very little, yeah? But this is the highlight of their Sukkot. So you're right, they stay in a hotel here, but they make sure to have the highlight to go to this Sukkah and that Sukkah, and I don't need to look inside. So you're right, people that feel that they have to do it for the family. I would not say to stop. Don't make the kids to feel miserable. It's the worstest thing. It's the worstest thing. All of us know the famous story of Reb Moshe Feinstein. But he said that there was one person, he went into a sukkah, and on the walls of the sukkah was the papers of the person that when he came to the States, you know, every Sunday he was fired. Because he didn't come to work for Shabbos. And he kept these papers that he was fired, and from that he made the Kareishis in his sukkah. And he said, this person's kids, all of them became Shomer Shabbos. All of them remained Shomer Shabbos. A lot of them became even Kli Kodesh, but for sure nice, beautiful families. You have people that were fired for every Shabbos they didn't go to work, and all of their kids are not Shomer Shabbos. Because when they came home and they didn't have a work, they were fired from working in Shabbos. They were so, I lost my job. So hard to be a Yid. So hard. So bad energy. The kids just picked up and went somewhere else. For sure, the most important thing in Chinuch is, in our days, I tell it to everyone, and one word. Positive energy. Positive energy. You know, it's this week's parsha. You know why we went to Golis, the Pasuk says? For one reason, the reason we're in a galus is the kid has to see the father smiling, going to daven smiling. You're right. If the family feels that when they do it in the house will be a bad energy, we have to send them to a hotel.
We're speaking.
But you know, a lot of times it's not because of that. A lot of times it starts in the parents. They can't be bothered, and the kids start to grow up that they don't know what. My kids, I wanted to go away for Rosh Hashanah, not to a hotel. So a different neighborhood that I'm a shtickle rav there, and the neighborhood wants me to be there. And my kids are fighting with me. Abba, we are used to Rosh Hashanah in the house. We're not moving. I said, but the other shul, I'm the rav. I have to be in the other shul. They say, Rosh Hashanah, but I also need to be in the walls of the house. And my kids are not in the bubble days. All of them are computer-wise and, you know, programmers, etc. Very good kids, but, you know, open-minded, nice, healthy, Israeli-American, I'll call them American-Israeli, maybe even more. So a lot of it is also really how the parents bring them up. But I agree that if the father feels or the family feels that it's too tight to be in the house, maybe only stay one day, maybe join a program, like you said, programs that you could have a little bit from both, for sure.
You're listening to us on WMCA 570, or you can listen to us on WMCA.com or on Nachum Siegel Network at NachumSiegel.com. And any questions, you can always email us at questions@headlinesbook.com. We're speaking to Arav HaGoyin, Rav Nissen Kaplan, Drash Yeshiva in the Mir, one of the Drash Yeshivas in the Mir, one of the most popular. He has over 200 boys in the shir. I don't think there's a single shir in America that has 200 boys, and very popular. You can listen to him online. He gets rave reviews, the shiurim that are posted online. As somebody who has many Yungalite, married individuals in your shiur, let me ask you a few questions about Shalom Bayis. could somebody lie for the sake of Shalom Bayis?
We have a story in the Gemara that the Gemara really brings down that you could lie. The Gemara says that one of the Amoraim, his wife, prepared for him food that he didn't like. If he would ask for fish, he would get chicken. Right. If he would ask for chicken, he would get fish. And his son asked him, Ta, so why, instead of asking for fish, you know she would give chicken. When you want fish, ask for chicken, you'll get fish. And he told him, Midvar Sheker Tichik. I'm using the question of the kid, not the answer of the father. The father was in a higher madrega. The question of the kids really teaches us that a person is allowed to. Mishum Shlom Bayis, you're allowed to lie. Is a tshuva in the Ramo that a person, a lady, had a baby before she was married, or maybe under she was married, be'oines, and then she had a baby with her husband. They were about to go to the Pidin Aben.
Shaila Bracha Levatola.
And the question, Shaila Bracha Levatola. And the Ramo says, "Shmi shenichta b'kedusha imoche al ha'mayim." Hakadosh Baruch Hu for Shlom Bayis, let's erase his name. Chofetz Chaim speaks about it. If you're allowed to say shvua for Shlom Bayis, I'm not going into the question of the bracha la'aloche. I'm not going into the question of the shvua, but to lie, you're allowed to for Shlom Bayis. But there's a big but. A person has to know the lying for Shlom Bayis is the last solution in his life. Why? Normally, lying in marriage is the beginning of the end of the marriage. Lying in the marriage. I heard a story this week. A young man came to ask me. His wife wanted him to go to put money in the bank. She was in charge. She had the pants in the family. She ran it. But she asked him in the way to Koilel. And he said, yeah, he wakes up early. He will do it in the way to Koilel. The Koilel, I think, starts 9 o'clock in the morning. For sure, he woke up 9-ish, 10-ish. He got to the bank 11:30. He put in the money, and he went to the Koilel. He calls back home. His wife asks him, yeah, you did it? Yeah, in the way to Koilel early in the morning, I did it. She asks him if she could get the receipt. Now, he already thought about it, so he tore off the time. You know, on the bottom of the receipt, you have the hour when he deposited the money. So she asked him, what happened to the bottom of the paper? So he said, oh, you're mistaken, it got torn. Unpurposely. In the meantime, he's using your Eitzah to lie for Shlom Bayis, right? He didn't realize that a month later, when the statements came in the mail, today it comes an email, was the hour when he deposited. If he would say, I'm sorry, I got up late, could be she'll be upset for a day. Could be for 2 days. But after a month, she realized he lied. She thinks, who knows what else he's cheating. Who knows what else he's doing? Lying is the worstest thing. Rav Shach told me once.
So if your wife
don't say the truth.
If your wife asks you if her dress is nice, what are you supposed to say?
I think these kind of lies, you have to say that it's nice. The Gemara says, Besilil, we say, Kalanova. We tell her you're pretty. It doesn't make a difference. She doesn't have to hear it from different people. She could hear it from her husband. It's a Gemara. We don't say Kala Kmoy Shehi. We say that she's pretty, for sure. And again, these are lies that I don't think that you could be caught. And I'm saying again, even lies that you have to be caught, if you need for Shlom Bayis, you're allowed to. But like I'm saying, number one is the marriage member. The first thing that makes a real marriage is a lie. Because marriage is based on trust. In the Ksuba we write down, they will not really speak about money. I don't think it means about these kind of things. But the idea is that it's a trust. And you know yourself, if your wife lies to you, how upset you get.
So,
also, I think it's not the right way to bring up a family. A person lies once, he goes into the mood and mourned, and he starts to lie and lie and lie.
What about other halachas for Shalom Bayis? The wife has one standard of
kashrus. So I heard from my father, Rav Ruderman told him that he was with the Chofetz Chaim, and it was the time to light Hanukkah candles, and the Chofetz Chaim's wife was not home yet. It was a question if to wait for his wife or not. The Pi Halacha, you don't need it to be there. And the Chofetz Chaim, this is what I think, I remember my father told me, I didn't check it now, my father is a Naftali captain, he's a Talmud of Baltimore Yeshiva, he was very, very close to David Krungis and to Ruderman, he was like a Talmud Muvak. And I think the Chofetz Chaim told him, it's a Gemara, Nechanike Shlem Bais, if you have to light a Nechanike, or to light a Shabbos candles, Shlem Bais Adif. So you could have said, there is two mitzvahs. What mitzvah to choose? The Hanukkah candles or the Shabbos candles? Choose the Shabbos. Chofetz Chaim took it one more step. The Shlom Bayis is more important, for sure, from not skipping the mitzvah, but from doing the mitzvah in a lighter oven, in a lighter way, wait for your wife. Now again, like I said before, there's a famous story, and I'm asking Mechila, you know what, I would say without the name, because it's a very chashuv shishiva in America, and I don't want to get into trouble. But I heard it from very reliable sources. He was learning in Lakewood. Now, actually, now he's living in a struggle. Shiva is one of the gedolim in Eretz Yisrael. And he was learning in Lakewood. And every morning he got to yeshiva, and davened in yeshiva. Suddenly, he stopped to daven in Lakewood yeshiva. Rav Nosson, I called it, the Mashgiach, father of Shiva Rebbe Liber, called him over and told him, what happened to you? For 3 or 4 years, you didn't be a shachis. Said, Rosh Shiva, Mashkiach, I'll tell you what happened. I was in the way to davening, and I heard screaming. I went up, and I saw the almana with 4 little kids. She's not managing to dress them and to take them out to the bus to the carpool. So I helped her to prepare the sandwiches. And I missed having an yeshiva. The other day it happened again. The third day it happened again. I just told her, don't worry, I'll just be there every morning. Mashgiach, I did the right thing or I did the wrong thing? He said, you did the right thing, but just tell me who is his family in Lakewood. I don't know about the Salmana. Lakewood was not so big then, yeah? He said, it's my wife with my 4 kids.
Right, I heard.
My own wife. But this story I say over every time.
Let me add on a story, not a dissimilar story. They say over from the Chafetz Chaim, I don't know if it was the Chafetz Chaim, but it's a Sheina Maisa, that he came to a town, and everybody wanted to have him by their table. And there was one very mechubid, some mechubid got him by the table, and he invited all his friends, and they had 50 people in Chafetz Chaim. And when he came to make Hamaitzi, he saw that one of the two chalas was broken off a piece. It wasn't a shalom. So he said to his wife, we don't have shleimim, we don't have shleimim. And he was embarrassed, his wife. So Chafetz Chaim said, the reason we cover the challah on Shabbos is not to embarrass it because of the wine.
Yeah.
So he said, if an inanimate object...
Beautiful.
We're so makbid on the Derech Eretz. How do we embarrass a person because of the fact that it's... missing the point, right?
But in the same time, I told the Yingalite. Especially first say over the story because I want them to get the message very clearly. But I want to tell the guy, if you start to daven home, you will stay home every day. And then davening will be 5 minutes. Shlom Bayis could move away temporarily a minyan, temporarily to get late to Seder. If it starts to happen often, you need help. You can't carry on staying home. Shlom Bayis could be a one-time thing, to be makel and things of the halacha you're allowed to be makel, for sure not to be over halachas. If you start to set it like a standard, what happens is you start to go down. First, it's not good religious reasons. It's not right to the Ribbono Shel Olam, but I will tell you more from that. It will not give you Shalom Bayis. In the end, your wife will make you so upset, you feel so disgusted that because of that, you stop to be who you are. And a part of the Jewish person, for example. A minyan is a part of the person. It's a part of the Jewish thing. Even if you leave yeshiva, even if you're in the world, a minyan is the structure of Klal Yisrael. So I first tell them the story to understand that if the wife needs sometimes help, you have to stay home. But then to understand that it's not an option. It's not an option. You could help the whole day in your house. And I give the example. I say, I have a friend that lived with me in yeshiva. He became a diamond person. He's running around the world. No one tells him, oh, Shlom Bayis, help your wife. I come back a little bit late from my learning. Where is the Shlom Bayis? What is the answer? Him and his wife understand that for him bringing money to the house is important for him to be out. So she's not upset and she's not demanding him to be there to help, right? You have to make your learning important enough for you and your wife that you will understand that you're bringing something important. If you feel that your wife is not feeling that, check if you're not learning like you have to learn. Maybe she realizes you're not unreal. Because if she would realize that you're collecting diamonds, like the other one lets the other one to go to collect diamonds, she will let you. So again, sometimes you're allowed to, but never to make it a kvius. Again, sometimes your wife is very sick and you have to do it for a week. That's what I mean. But it's, again and again, in the middle of Seder, for example, she calls you, she needs help. You deserve that she called you. Why your phone has to be open? I'm not saying she's expecting, leave the phone open, for sure, maybe she needs help. But if you answer everyone's phone, for sure you'll get phone calls for help. But when you're in the middle of a meeting with the president, your phone will not be open.
Well, I'll share a story with you. Years ago when I was in the Mir, I learned for a number of years with Rav Ashar Yehli B'Chavrus, so we became very friendly. And after I went to work, I came back to Eretz Yisrael once, he invited me and my wife for a suda. And he asked me about, you know, the type of hours that I work. So I told him there are times, you know, I'm on. And he looked at his wife and he said, oh, you see what kind of hours you put in when you work? And he was like making this point, like, you know, like you say, sometimes people say, oh, and when we do it for work, everybody understands. And sometimes when we do it for learning, suddenly all kinds of
heads. Every working guy leaves now 6 o'clock. Exactly. He leaves 6 o'clock.
On
Kinetarium. Yeah, he goes out to Manhattan. And he doesn't help the almana with the four kids.
Exactly, yeah. Well, thank you very much, Rav HaGoyin, Rav Nissen Kaplan, one of Rosh Yeshiva Nemir, for Yedivrei Halacha, Yedivrei Hisoyrus. Can I ask that we finish? You have so many Talmidim who listen. Finish off with a bracha.
I want to bet everyone that you will be zeicha, teksiva, v'chasima toiva. Ezra Hashem, we'll have a year that we'll be zeicha together to lavoy the Hashem besimcha, with a lot of love to the Ribbono Shel Olam, happiness in our own life, shalom bayis, nachas from our kids, closeness in the family, healthy and gizunt and parnose, and ksiva v'chasima teva to all of Klal Yisrael, and thank you for you, for this beautiful time together. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Kol tov, a good year.